Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Oral, Head, and Neck Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 950 participants, and you really come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, the Philippines, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you're spending the next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you have received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about the program itself, about our speakers and the topics we'll be addressing, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource to each of you to use. These are free resources for you to use so that you can get help at no cost. In addition, there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs that you would like us to offer going forward? This program we offer a few times a year, really based on your recommendations and requests to offer this topic. So please tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forward and what you think of the program so that we can be sure to be responsive and develop programs that really best meet your needs. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Terry Day, and Dr. Day is Wendy and Keith Wellen, Endowed Chair in Head and Neck Surgery, Professor and Director, Division of Head and Neck Oncologic Surgery, Vice Chair for Clinical Affairs, Medical University of South Carolina, Hollings Cancer Center. And Dr. Day is going to address an overview of oral and head and neck cancer, staging and diagnosing, and surgical interventions, including plastic and reconstructive surgery. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Day, and I have to say that Dr. Day has had a very long-standing interest in education workshops like this and in awareness campaigns around oral and head and neck cancer. So it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Day.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to be a part of this program today, and I would like to thank Cancer Care once again and all the sponsors and contributors for their commitment to the patients, families, and friends that are affected by head and neck cancer. Really, the importance of the interprofessional and multidisciplinary care cannot be overemphasized, and I'd like to start by discussing that. And it's important, I think, for every patient as well as the clinicians that are getting involved in head and neck cancer care to understand that this really is an interprofessional endeavor when you take on the care of a patient with head and neck cancer. And it involves psychologists, psychiatrists, palliative care clinicians, social workers, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, ENT doctors, oral surgery doctors, dentists, prosthodontists, speech pathologists, nurses, nutritionists, reconstructive surgeons, radiologists, pathologists, and a lot of this happens behind the scenes. And a patient may not realize that all of these people are involved in their care, but I really want to emphasize that that should take place and patients should be offered the multidisciplinary care anytime they're diagnosed with an oral and head and neck cancer. Coincidentally, maybe not so much, this is Oral Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Week around the world, and tomorrow is the International Day of Free Screening. So if you need more information or want to get checked for a head and neck cancer, you can go to ohanca.com. It stands for Oral Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Week, and find a free screening site nearest you. If your dentist or physician is not doing a free screening, please encourage them to do so next year, because that's one way to get the word out. So today I'm going to cover a brief overview of what oral head and neck cancer is, go into the recent progress in the treatment of these cancers, and then coping with surgery as well as reconstruction. So our first section is overview of head and neck cancer. Oral head and neck cancer commonly refers to cancers that affect the mouth and parts of the throat and the lined surfaces of the nose, mouth, throat, sinuses, and voice box. Although it's often described as the sixth most common cancer in the world, in the United States and other countries, one subset of these cancers is rising rapidly in incidence, and these are cancers of the tonsil and the base of the tongue. This is a cancer that's now commonly found in Caucasian males, usually in middle age, who are non-smokers, and it seems that the majority by far are related to a virus, the human papillomavirus. Studies over recent years have also revealed that smoking seems to affect the cure rate, with the amount of tobacco use sometimes related to the cure rate in patients with all head and neck cancers, not just those with HPV. The studies have also shown there's now over 50,000 head and neck squamous cell carcinomas per year in the United States, with almost all that can be treated. The cure rate depends on a number of factors, and please ask your physician about some of these factors if you have questions. It's also frequent that doctors involved in treating these cancers, these sites also treat other sites and types of cancers in the head and neck region, including salivary glands, sinus, nasopharynx, skin cancer, melanoma, thyroid cancer, and sarcomas. Due to the limited time today, we will not cover these other areas in great detail. But it is important to remember that the side effects of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy for these other cancers can be similar to those with the squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck. So first, I'm going to go into the diagnosis. And a patient that has a new head and neck cancer, diagnosis is paramount. The diagnosis of an early oral cancer, for example, is typically made when a physician or dentist identifies a red or white patch in the mouth or throat. Thus, any sore in the mouth, sore throat, change in voice, lumps in the neck that do not resolve within a few weeks should be evaluated by a specialist. Sometimes these head and neck cancers that are in the mouth or throat first show up as an enlarged lymph node in the neck. Thus, any adult with a lump in the neck should also have that evaluated. A recent study published in JAMA Otolaryngology revealed that most HPV-positive oropharyngeal cancers were diagnosed with a lump in the neck as the first sign or symptom, whereas the ones that were not related to the virus were diagnosed when a patient noticed a sore throat or change in swallowing. We also know from many years' experience that a change in the voice is often the first sign or symptom of a voice box cancer. Of course, most head and neck cancers have been found to be related to smoking. However, it's now known that up to half or more of those of the back of the throat behind the tongue are related to the human papillomavirus. So if you don't smoke cigarettes, it's important still to get checked if you have any of these signs or symptoms. If you have an oropharyngeal cancer, cancer of the base of tongue or tonsil, ask your physician if it has been tested for the virus. Once the spot is identified in the mouth or throat, the patient may be referred to a specialist for a biopsy. Sometimes before or after the biopsy is done, the patients may be scheduled for a CT scan, an MRI scan, or a PET scan, or a combination thereof, to look for the tumor, where it's located, and where it might have spread. In most cases, a biopsy of the tumor, which is where it began, is called the primary site, is done, or a needle biopsy can be done of the lump in the neck, which is known as a lymph node. This can often provide the cell type of the tumor. Thus, you would know where the tumor started, which is the primary site. You would know the cell type, and then the stage is done after this is identified. The results of the biopsy and the site and the stage then direct treatment recommendations. At this time, the patient should be referred to a multidisciplinary team of specialists, which at least includes head and neck surgeon, radiation oncologist, medical oncologist, and dentist and speech pathologist. So now I'll go into the stage. After the scans and biopsy, the patient is given a stage of the tumor, which I will review now. The other category of these cancers that determines the best treatment is a stage which is considered by the TNM stage. T stands for tumor, N for lymph nodes, and M for metastasis. The M stands for spread beyond the head and neck region to other parts of the body. The entire T, N, and M stage is then grouped together to make a full stage that is staged according to the American Joint Committee on Cancer, or AJCC. More details on this can be found at the National Comprehensive Cancer Network website, nccn.org. And that helps you identify what treatment option would be identified for the particular location, type, and stage of head and neck cancer. I'll now move into the treatment of oral head and neck cancer. It is well understood from scientific research, clinical trials, and published experiences that each stage, site, and type of cancer should be treated in a particular way. However, as more information becomes available, more drugs are available, more treatments and literature is available, the controversies and options for each stage and site may become quite confusing to the patient and family during this strenuous time. So I will summarize the treatment in a few sentences and then expand on this to follow. To generalize, all head and neck cancers are treated with either surgery or radiation therapy as the definitive treatment, and these comprise the curative treatment modalities. Chemotherapy is often added, oftentimes in combination with radiation therapy, to provide a treatment-related benefit. Most head and neck cancers, however, will be treated with combinations of treatment that will include a variety of combinations and sequences of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. So if I was going to generalize the early stage and late stage cancers into one treatment option, early stage cancers, or stage 1 or 2 cancers, can be cured often with surgery or radiation therapy alone without combined treatment with chemotherapy. However, advanced stage, which would be stage 3 or 4 cancers, are often treated with one of several combinations of treatment. These could be surgery followed by radiation therapy, chemotherapy and radiation therapy, or a combination of all three, surgery followed by radiation and chemotherapy. There are now targeted molecular therapies, including cetuximab, that can be given in place of chemotherapy or in combination, and further studies are underway to determine which is the best for each patient. The details surrounding the chemotherapy and radiation therapy will be covered in quite detail by Dr. Worden to follow. So now I'll discuss briefly the advances in surgical therapy and reconstruction. Surgery for early stage cancers can be performed in many cases, and what once was not available were these minimally invasive techniques of surgery where people can have surgery that's done through the mouth with endoscopes, lasers, and robotic surgery arms. We now use three-dimensional images, CAT scans, and MRIs to identify the location of the tumor, help with the surgery, and help with the reconstruction. So what once also couldn't be done without a airway tube or tracheotomy tube in the neck or feeding tube in the nose can now be done through the mouth in many situations without incisions on the outside of the face or the neck. Advances in advanced stage cancer, stage 3 and 4 head and neck cancer, includes the option of removing the cancer, removing the lymph nodes, and then rebuilding the area with what's called a free flap or microvascular free tissue transfer. This is essentially a transplant of tissue that includes different tissues like skin, fat, muscle, and bone, in addition to nerves, from another part of the body to the head and neck region. So essentially, we try to replace like tissue with like tissue. So if part of the tongue was removed, it would be replaced with tissue that would mimic the tongue and aid in speech and swallowing. If the jawbone or parts of the face or bone had to be removed, it could then be rebuilt with bone from the arm or the leg or the back. All of these are done not only to replace the tissue, but to improve a patient's ability to chew, eat, swallow, and talk, in addition to the cosmetic improvements. Finally, one of the most important aspects of head and neck cancer treatment are the psychosocial issues surrounding head and neck cancer and its treatment. In my early years of caring for patients and their families, I really thought most patients just wanted their cancer cured. The more I spend time getting to know the patients and their families, the more important quality of life has been realized by myself as well as my colleagues. This will be covered in more detail later in the program, but I did want to emphasize that that's an important part of head and neck cancer treatment because the areas in the head and neck are crucial to the activities of daily living. Many of the large head and neck centers in the United States will offer this interprofessional and multidisciplinary care for their head and neck cancers, and I encourage every new patient and their family member to seek care in one of these areas. It has been a privilege participating in this important teleconference. I encourage everyone to continue their efforts to improve the research funding, education, and awareness that eventually results in eradication of head and neck cancers. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you, Doctor. Thank you very much. And could you give everyone the website again for the This Week Awareness campaign? I think everyone would like to. I'm sure people were writing it down, but if you could repeat that, I'm sure that would be helpful to everyone.
Yes, it's Oral Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Week, and to spell it out, it's OHANCAW.com. And they can find out free screening sites around the world. There's hundreds of sites available, and people can go to those locations. Some of them require an appointment or a sign-up online. Others, I think you can show up, but go to that website and find out. And again, for the physicians and dentists not participating, it's never too late. These free screenings can be done year-round by anybody anywhere and really help identify these cancers and get people in for the right treatment sooner.
So it's OHANCAW.com.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for that excellent presentation and really for setting the stage for the whole program. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Francis Warden. Dr. Warden is Associate Professor, Lead Medical Oncologist, Head and Neck Oncology, University of Michigan. And Dr. Warden is going to address new chemotherapy options, concurrent chemotherapy and radiotherapy, key questions in making your treatment decisions, pain and symptom management, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to bring Dr. Warden on board, and we're delighted to have him with us today. Dr. Warden?
Thank you, Dr. Mesner. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. First, I wanted to expand a little bit about the staging, what Dr. Day has been alluding to thus far. And that will help set the stage for us to talk about various treatment options. So, if we talk about the early stage disease, those are the cancers that are confined primarily to the tongue or the tonsil or the voice box. We talk about locally advanced disease. We're talking about cancers that involve those sites I mentioned, but now the lymph nodes in the neck. And then finally, there's a category of metastatic disease, which is essentially cancer that is not curable. So we move forward and talk about these various categories. In terms of new chemotherapy options, we go back to the locally advanced disease, and those would be treated with chemotherapy and radiation therapy, or patients who present with disease that's just confined to perhaps the vocal cord of the tongue could be treated with surgery or perhaps radiation by itself and don't even need chemotherapy. So when we talk about the locally advanced tumors and the chemotherapy agents that are involved, cisplatin is the drug that still remains at the forefront of treatment with radiation therapy. In the past couple years, there have not been any new agents that have been approved by the FDA for the treatment of head and neck cancer. The most recent advances have come with the drug that Dr. Day mentioned called cetuximab. This drug actually binds to a protein on the cell surface of the cancer and actually causes changes to the cancer, leading the cancer cells to ultimately die. This treatment is given in combination with radiation therapy and in combination with chemotherapy for advanced or metastatic disease we'll talk about in a moment. So we talk about chemotherapy options with radiation therapy for locally advanced disease. We essentially have two treatment options, one with a cisplatin based chemotherapy, which means that the cisplatin would be given at the same time of the radiation therapy. Similarly, cetuximab can also be given with radiation therapy at the same time, meaning that once radiation starts, these chemotherapy drugs are administered, and they are given during the course of radiation therapy. None is given after, and chemotherapy in general is not recommended for treatment beforehand. We have several studies now that show that chemotherapy before chemotherapy and radiation therapy is really not that effective. The question of whether cetuximab is with radiation is equivalent to cisplatin and radiation for these locally advanced cancers still remains unanswered. There is a large clinical study enrolling about 800 patients, which has now closed, but statisticians and the investigators are analyzing the data. So soon we will have that data to tell us whether or not we can use either cisplatin with radiation or perhaps cetuximab in radiation. The benefit of using cetuximab may be that it has less toxicity than cisplatin. Cisplatin can cause hearing loss, it can cause tingling and numbness in the hands and feet, and it can also cause problems with one's kidneys. Cetuximab, on the other hand, does not have those properties as adverse side effects, but can cause a rash and the possibility of an allergic-like reaction. But the allergic reactions are relatively rare. When we move on and talk about metastatic cancers, or those that are not curable, we have recent data from a study that's been published a couple years ago now that tells us that we should be combining cetuximab, that agent that binds against the protein on the cell surface of the cancers, with cisplatin or another agent called carboplatin, and in combination with other drugs called taxanes, which are agents such as docetaxel and paclitaxel. And these drugs all work differently to lead to the kill of cancer cells. Additionally, another drug called 5-fluorouracil has also been combined with platinum and also with cetuximab. So now we actually recommend that the patients who have metastatic disease and whose performance status means they're healthy enough to get it should be receiving free drug therapy for their metastatic disease. So cetuximab, a platinum agent, which means cisplatin or carboplatin, and then perhaps a taxane, again, docetaxel or paclitaxel, and perhaps 5-fluorouracil. New studies are being done to look at new investigational studies are being done to look at new agents that could potentially benefit patients. I know at our own university, we're conducting several clinical studies, and there's a specialist who will speak about clinical studies in a few moments. But nonetheless, I believe some of these newer agents may provide additional benefit to our standard chemotherapy and may also help to improve quality of life in that the side effect profiles of these newer agents are not as severe as that given with chemotherapy. So moving onward to concurrent chemotherapy and radiotherapy, when we see patients with locally advanced disease, we have them evaluated by our surgeons first. So every patient with head and neck cancer should be evaluated by a qualified head and neck surgeon. That surgeon will determine whether or not the disease, your cancer, is surgically resectable or being able to be removed with surgery or not. The reason we want to know this question is that patients who have cancers that are not removable by surgery in general have a prognosis which is more guarded or severe than a patient whose tumor could be removed. But the reason we give chemotherapy and radiation therapy in place of having surgery for these cancers is because we want to preserve quality of life, meaning, for example, if someone has a tonsil or base of tongue or back part of the tongue cancer with lymph node involvement, the surgery would require total removal of the tongue, which would render a person the inability to speak, swallow food, etc. So we offer people what we call organ preservation with combined chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Sometimes radiation therapy is enough, meaning that a patient's performance status or their ability to carry out their activities of daily living are limited, and chemotherapy along with radiation therapy can have more side effects. So sometimes these patients are treated with radiation therapy alone. But in general, most patients with what we call locally advanced tumors, those again with lymph nodes in the neck and involvement at a primary site, are treated in combination with chemotherapy and radiation therapy. As I have alluded to earlier, we necessarily do not give chemotherapy beforehand, nor do we give chemotherapy after the delivery of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. This adds only toxicity, and there is no data to actually suggest that we can improve survival. During treatment with chemotherapy and radiation therapy, it's important that you are seen regularly by your physician or nurse practitioners so they can evaluate your speech and swallowing for difficulties or what they call dysfunction, and to help manage pain, nutrition, and sedation. All are issues that can arise when treatment with chemotherapy and radiation therapy, because we're radiating parts of the voice box or parts of the mouth, which, and when and received in large doses like we give with radiation therapy and head and neck cancer, can have very severe side effects, in particular pain. So we like to talk to patients about management of pain and different methods we can help to reduce problems with the decay of teeth and to help make sure that calories are being consumed so weight is not lost too much. Additionally, it's always important when patients receive chemotherapy and radiation therapy that we talk to them about receiving exercise. Exercise is very important because we know people become very deconditioned when they sit around and lay around a lot. Additionally, it's also important to note that people who are in reclining states or in the bed or chair almost all day are at risk to develop blood clots. So we like to help overcome that issue by having people exercise and to maintain muscle tone so that when they finish their treatment, their recovery is much better. Moving on to ask key questions during your evaluation with your head and neck oncologist and your surgeon radiation oncologist, I think there are several things that I'd like to mention that you ask. The first would be, do I need chemotherapy? And why is it good for me to get chemotherapy, or why is it not good for me to receive chemotherapy? Dr. Day talked about this, but I think it's important that you ask about the HPV status of your tumor. There are many questions, and it's beyond the scope of the discussion today, about HPV-related disease and how it can have an effect on one's partner, one's outcome and prognosis. So I think that's actually a very important question, as is, what is my prognosis associated with my head and neck cancer? Next, I think it's important that you should ask how often you should be followed. During chemotherapy and radiation therapy, in my own clinic, we follow the patients every week to ensure they're getting through their treatment adequately and their side effects and symptoms are well controlled. Additionally, after your treatment is finished, you will need close surveillance by the surgeon and radiation oncologist and even medical oncologists to ensure that your cancer has not come back and that if it has come back, what measures should be taken. And what can I help to get through? What can I do for myself to help me get through my treatment? I think this is an important question because, as I alluded to, the treatments for locally advanced head and neck cancer, including surgery and radiation therapy and chemotherapy, can be somewhat harsh. So it's important that you find access to information from your provider as to how you can best manage your own care. Additionally, I think if there are other personal issues that come up, a social worker should be consulted. And so you should ask about the availability of help there. And finally, where can I find more information? Please ask your provider what websites and what resources are available in your particular cancer center that may be helpful to your disease. Moving on then to talk about pain and symptom management. First, talking about patients with metastatic disease, sometimes these cancers, when they're not curable, can go to the bones and other problems. And we treat those patients with narcotics, things like morphine, agents such as oxycodone or Dilaudid. The point I want to bring up to you here is that it's important that we control your pain and that you not worry about addiction. Oftentimes people will present and are very concerned about the addictive qualities of these drugs. These drugs are there to help you control your pain. When we talk about chemotherapy and radiation therapy, there's an intense inflammatory effect. So inflammation is something similar to if you fall in your knee and your knee becomes very puffy and swollen. The same kind of thing can happen in the head and neck when radiation therapy is delivered, especially when chemotherapy is given at the same time. We will give patients agents such as steroids along with our narcotics such as the morphine, oxycodone, and or Dilaudid. And these agents can actually help decrease the swelling. Additionally, you should ask your physician about the use of mouthwashes and mouth rinses. One of the basic mouth rinses that has been most helpful is the use of salt water in salt in warm water, so salt water rinses, to help to reduce the inflammatory effect of the radiation therapy and chemotherapy in combination. So it's important that you always contact your provider if your pain is not controlled. If your pain is not adequately controlled, it's going to inhibit your ability to swallow adequately and to take in adequate calories. You'll end up dehydrated and oftentimes hospitalized. So we do our best efforts to help control pain to keep people out of the hospital. And then finally, moving on to communicating with the healthcare team. I think this is extremely important because there are several people who are involved with your involved with the management of your care. So your surgeon will diagnose you with your head and neck cancer and will help guide the treatment, whether it's surgery followed by radiation therapy, surgery alone, or perhaps radiation therapy alone. And like I said, with the big number of patients today, we're treating them upfront with chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Because as Dr. Day alluded to, a big portion of our patients are actually HPV-related or have HPV-related tumors. So we will treat those patients, again, with chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Then those questions should be directed to those administering the treatment, so your radiation oncologist and your medical oncologist. The bottom line is, it's important that we hear from you, because if we don't hear from you, there is a good chance that there could be alterations in your treatment which could lead to devastating outcomes. In other words, we never really want to take breaks in treatment from radiation therapy, as the cancer cells can, what they call, repopulate or regrow very quickly. So you always want to keep on a main schedule that has been provided by your radiation oncologist. So I think it's important that if you're running into problems, you always contact your medical oncologist and or your radiation oncologist. It's important to note, too, that we all work together. Our surgeons, radiation oncologists, and medical oncologists constantly communicate about your care. So it's important that you provide information to at least one of these providers so that the entire team knows what's going on. And again, this may be important because we may end up actually holding chemotherapy, but again, the most important thing for these locally advanced cancers is to deliver the radiation therapy in its entirety. So with that said, I'd like to again thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Warden. That was a very comprehensive and just an excellent presentation. And I really want to thank you for really bringing all this information to our participants today. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Douglas Peterson. And Dr. Peterson is Professor of Oral Medicine, Department of Oral Health and Diagnostic Sciences, School of Dental Medicine. He's Chair, Program in Head and Neck Cancer and Oral Oncology, NAE Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is going to address guidelines for clinical care before, during, and after cancer treatments, and he's also going to discuss clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Peterson, who is a frequent presenter on our head and neck teleconferences. Dr. Peterson?
Thanks so much, Carolyn. It is my privilege, really, to be part of this important conversation. And just to add to the discussion, I'll start by saying that there are some very important and highly successful dental approaches that can be utilized before, during, and after the treatment of oral and head and neck cancer. And the collective goal is to prevent or at least minimize any problems with the patient's mouth during the cancer treatment and the years following the cancer treatment. And I'll be summarizing some of these approaches during my part of the presentation. I'd also like to emphasize there are some excellent resources, such as the Cancer Care Program, for patients and their families and for the cancer team that help guide us as a partnership during this decision-making and the dental treatments and integrating those dental treatments into the overall cancer care model. Now, much of this decision-making is based on the staging and the location of the mouth or the head and neck cancer. This is one of the reasons why screening and early detection are so important, as very effectively highlighted by Dr. Day. The earlier the diagnosis of mouth or head and neck cancer is made, the sooner the oncology team can begin treatment that is customized for maximizing cure and minimizing any side effects, including side effects of the mouth. And as Dr. Warden mentioned, communication among the healthcare team is extremely important. It really helps us when you ask us your questions, express your concerns, so that we can provide the very best care possible. And it can also, hopefully, alleviate any concerns that you might have by having this kind of ongoing conversation. So working together with the healthcare team can go a long way to preventing or minimizing complications in the mouth over many, many years. Now, I might next comment on what's new relative to guidelines for mouth care, dental care, for the head and neck cancer patient. As we've heard from Drs. Day and Warden, there are exciting recent advances for head and neck cancer treatment. These advances, for example, include highly innovative technologies to focus the delivery of radiation directly to the cancer and minimize any side effects to normal tissues, as well as we've heard, the development of new drugs and what we call biologics that are specifically focused to attack the cancer cells and not the normal cells. And these advances in radiation, drugs, and biologics and the way we deliver them often permit the cancer team to protect more of the normal tissue, including tissues of the mouth. And just by protecting normal tissues, we can go a long way to minimizing any mouth complications. Now, I'd like to balance that with the idea of what's not quite as new as these innovative approaches in cancer treatment, yet continues to be so foundationally important. Well, if you'll permit me, I'll say that the words, the definitions, continue to be important. For example, when we think dental, we may think about the whole mouth. Actually, in the dental profession, when we say dental, we think in terms of the teeth. And when we think about the oral cavity or the mouth, we think about the teeth, the gums, the lining tissues of the mouth, we call that the mucosa, as well as the salivary glands. So when we start talking about head and neck radiation, for example, with or without the chemotherapy that Dr. Day mentioned, this cancer regimen, this head and neck regimen, can cause temporary or sometimes permanent changes in the mouth tissues. It may be dental, it may be of the gums, it may be of the salivary glands. And therefore, given the complexity of these mouth complications, it's very important, as we've heard, to have comprehensive interprofessional management. Now, some of these complications occur only during the cancer treatment itself and the few weeks after the cancer treatment ends. For example, the sore mouth or the inflammation that Dr. Warden was talking about. Another word for that is mucositis. Now, some other complications of the mouth may persist for the rest of the life of the patient, such as dry mouth that's caused by injury to the salivary glands from the radiation. And there is the potential risk, although it's not highly common, but we need to be very careful and aware, of a condition of the bone called osteoradionecrosis. And this is a condition in a relatively small subset of patients who've had head and neck radiation, mainly to the lower jaw. And over time, the ability of the lower jaw to fight infection and other challenges is reduced by the radiation, and this can in turn lead to some bone complications. Now, the good news is that the mouth sores, the mucositis, can be managed, and that the risk for the dry mouth or the osteoradionecrosis in the years that follow can be minimized as well by working with the healthcare team. So, for example, for the sore mouth, we really don't have the ability yet, although it's being worked on, to prevent the mucositis, the inflammation, from actually occurring. However, as Dr. Warden so thoughtfully put, the whole importance of pain control, working with the healthcare team, keeping the mouth moist, using basic salt rinses, for example, several times a day, and then bringing in pain medications that we can apply to the area of soreness, or if needed, give through pills or injections. All of these approaches are designed to help keep the mouth comfortable, minimize any pain until the condition goes away several weeks after the cancer therapy ends. Now, dry mouth is another condition that typically can be caused by medications during chemotherapy, but it can also be caused if the radiation to the head and neck directly attacks, if you will, the salivary glands. And the dry mouth can last for the lifetime of the patient and can cause difficulties in tasting and chewing and swallowing and speaking. Now, there are some very simple approaches, such as keeping the mouth moist through sipping water or sugarless drinks or avoiding caffeine. There's some techniques that we can use that can be very, very helpful in the many years after cancer treatment. And I'm going to defer to Ms. Anderson on some of the nutritional and dietary issues related to head and neck cancer management. Now, as I mentioned, it's also very important to have your mouth checked on a regular basis by the healthcare team in the months and the years following the cancer treatment, so that if a complication begins to develop, if you notice some soreness or an area of the gum that isn't healing quite right that was injured, or for Dr. Warden mentioned the dental cavities, if there are any conditions of which you become aware, then it's very important to communicate that to your healthcare team so that we can intervene early. In my last minute and a half, I'd like to really use this as an opportunity to talk about the importance of clinical studies. Dr. Warden mentioned that, and I'd like to just expand upon that as well, the clinical trials. You may be interested in considering opportunities for contributing to clinical research during your cancer treatment, including research involving mouth complications. Excellent opportunity to contribute to the greater good. There's certainly no obligation to participate in this research, and even if you decide not to participate in a clinical study, you'll still receive expert care by your cancer team, whether or not you decide to participate in the research. Having said that, many of the advances, virtually all of the advances that we're talking about today, are based on clinical studies given to us by patients previously. And so it really is a wonderful gift that you would give the scientific and the clinical community as well as to future patients. It really means the world to science and to the healthcare providers as well as the patients of the future. So if the opportunity arises for you to consider participation in a clinical study in the future, I hope you'll carefully consider this very important contribution. So I'll just summarize in my remaining minute and just, again, highlight that there are excellent approaches that the dental team, working in concert with the rest of the healthcare cancer team, can integrate into your cancer care before, during, and years after your cancer treatment. That conversation with the healthcare team throughout that lifelong journey is very, very important. The team can help you not only during, but after the cancer treatment itself, and it continues to be important to have that ongoing relation. And with that kind of communication and partnership, there can be very positive outcomes for you during your treatment as well as for many years thereafter. I'll stop at this point. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to participate.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Peterson. Excellent, really overview of many of these issues in terms of care of mouth and gum and teeth during treatment and after treatment, and also the highlighting of the clinical trials. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Jan Lewin. Dr. Lewin is professor, Department of Head and Neck Surgery, Section Chief, Speech Pathology and Audiology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Lewin is going to address speech and swallowing rehabilitation, and I also want to say that Dr. Lewin has been a stalwart supporter of these programs and has been on all of the programs that we've done on oral and head and neck cancer. So I'm going to now turn the program over to Dr. Lewin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's always a pleasure to participate, and I'm always happy to provide whatever I can. Let me say that speech and swallowing dysfunction are frequent consequences of head and neck cancer and its treatment. We know that more than 75% of patients treated for cancers of the vocal folds will experience changes in their voice, and we also know that at least 50% of head and neck cancer survivors have swallowing dysfunction, and they may not even realize it because the cancer treatment has affected their ability to sense the problem. We have also certainly learned that the ability to preserve the organ does not always ensure that the organ will function, and that patient outcomes will vary both in terms of cancer treatment response as well as response to rehabilitation or restoration. It's important to understand that the larynx and the pharynx engage in multiple functions that require extensive neural control, almost like a functional time sharing that has to ensure respiration, phonation, and deglutition while avoiding the adverse events such as aspiration. Therefore, evaluation is critical. Simply observing swallowing does not tell us anything about the physiology of the disorder, nor does it allow us to determine the etiology or cause of the problem, which in turn prevents us from establishing effective treatment to resolve the problem. Thus, treatment for swallowing disorders that is based on inaccurate identification of swallowing physiology is not only ineffective, but it's useless. It's also important to realize that patients' reports of speech and swallowing abilities are often unreliable. In other words, perception doesn't always equate with actual ability. Sometimes patients will report that they're swallowing quite normally, when in fact examination reveals abnormal swallowing function. Alternatively, patients with radiation-induced dry mouth or xerostomia frequently report abnormal swallowing when in fact their ability to swallow is quite normal. Data from the past 10 to 15 years has clearly shown that surgery or radiation therapy, with or without the addition of chemotherapy, will result in specific and sometimes different kinds of swallowing problems depending on the site of the tumor, the extent of the surgery, and the type of reconstruction. In general, however, patients who are treated surgically experience functional disabilities that are usually proportional to the volume of the resection. Following oral cavity resections, data shows that preservation of the anterior tongue function will be critical for speech production, but the tongue base remains the most essential lingual region for normal swallowing. Even after surgery that totally removes the oral tongue, a patient can learn to swallow safely as long as the base of tongue is preserved and continues to function. Findings also show that 98% of the speech produced by treated patients with advanced oral cancers will be intelligible even when the surgery includes the tongue. When reconstruction is needed, research has found that flaps that fill the surgical defect produce better ability to swallow and speak than bulky ones that overfill the space. Essentially, the degree of functional impairment often depends on the quality rather than the extent of the reconstruction. New data shows that endoscopic head and neck surgeries using lasers and robots may have better functional outcomes than traditional surgeries as well as radiation therapy. After these types of surgeries, patients generally have shorter hospital stays and experience faster medical recovery. Again, in select cases, radiation therapy may actually be avoided. Patients frequently regain swallowing ability faster without the severe side effects caused by radiation therapy. However, we are still investigating these alternatives, as well as the benefit of radiation therapy and its effect on speech and swallowing in patients who are treated with lasers, surgeries, and robotic techniques. However, not all patients are candidates for these surgeries. Research has shown that knowing baseline speech and swallowing abilities helps to predict post-treatment outcomes. Therefore, treatment selection should depend on evidence-based information to help patients select the right alternative to treat their cancer, while at the same time preserve the ability to speak and swallow after treatment. Alternatively, the effects of radiation therapy will produce immediate as well as long-term changes in speech, voice, and swallowing that may actually increase in severity years after the completion of the radiation. In general, radiation has a greater effect on swallowing than it does on speech. Patients who have swallowing problems before treatment are at higher risk for chronic swallowing disability after treatment, and they are at higher risk for permanent feeding tube dependence. The addition of chemotherapy can make the problems worse because chemotherapy accentuates the effects of the radiation. Early swallowing recovery from radiation therapy may be misleading because of the delayed scarring or fibrosis, along with the occurrence of neuropathies that cause long-term swallowing deterioration. Late swallowing dysfunction and aspiration have been reported in up to 60% of patients treated with radiation therapy, and in up to 70% of patients who aspirate do so silently without coughing or clearing their throat. Between 15 and 30% of patients who aspirate will require a feeding tube for nutrition. Research experience shows that delaying the placement of a feeding tube until it is needed may, in fact, help preserve long-term swallowing function. Our data and that of other investigators have shown, or has shown, that regardless of the presence of a feeding tube, it is absolutely essential to continue to swallow whatever you can, even if it is just your own saliva. Patients who do not take anything by mouth for longer than 2 weeks often experience worse long-term swallowing deterioration. Therefore, it is critically important that patients who receive radiation therapy continue to swallow throughout the course of radiation therapy to help ensure long-term swallowing ability. Recently, targeted molecular therapies or biologic treatments in combination with radiation are being used to pinpoint specific genetic alterations in the tumor itself and spare normal tissue cells from damage. In addition, two new trials through the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group and the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group will evaluate the ability to reduce or de-escalate the amount of radiation as part of the treatment for select patients with tumors of the oropharynx in an attempt to reduce the debilitating late effects of radiation therapy. It is also important to know that a late onset of swallowing problems that occurs more than 1 year after the completion of radiation may not be a long-term effect of the radiation treatment, but rather an indication of recurrent disease. Therefore, it is important that patients who experience late occurring swallowing problems be properly evaluated by a physician to rule out the presence of a new cancer. New research has defined specific swallowing exercises that target the muscle groups that will likely be impaired after head and neck cancer treatment. Recent data support the use of these preventative swallowing exercises that start early before the cancer treatment begins. Our data from our program at MD Anderson Cancer Center shows that 92% of patients who adhere to exercises and continue to eat during radiation therapy return to a regular diet compared to 65% who neither eat nor exercise. It is important to remember that there are no pills, no medications, and in most cases, no surgeries that will fix swallowing problems once they have occurred. Findings show that patients who perform these swallowing exercises before, during, and after treatment have a better swallowing-related quality of life, maintain adequate muscle tone and physiology, and are less dependent on feeding tubes both during and after treatment. Therefore, patients should ask for swallowing exercises before radiation therapy begins and continue to do them as best they can throughout their treatment. It is also just as important that patients ask questions about recommended swallowing therapy as it is to ask questions about their cancer treatment. There are some treatments that may not be well suited for patients with head and neck cancer. For example, electrical or surface stimulation placed against the neck to induce muscle movement is frequently being used to improve swallowing. Despite its therapeutic popularity, data suggests that electrical or surface stimulation may actually make swallowing function worse in some patients. Therefore, it is very important that the appropriateness of electrical or surface stimulation, or any other swallowing therapy for that matter, be properly evaluated and its efficacy confirmed before it is used. In conclusion, clinical and research experience show that in many cases, long-term speech and swallowing dysfunction can be avoided. Despite the research and clinical evidence, many patients with oral and head and neck cancer are still not referred for speech and swallowing evaluation. Thus, they do not receive essential therapy to prevent long-term problems. Early concentrated intervention is critical. We here at MD Anderson Cancer Center are partnering with colleagues to develop a predictive model for the prevention of speech and swallowing dysfunction with the ultimate goal to identify at-risk patients to avoid long-term functional deterioration after treatment for head and neck cancer. And with that, I will conclude and again thank you very much for the opportunity to participate in these incredibly important seminars. Thanks, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Lewin. That was just extraordinary presentation. Thank you so much, just wonderful material. And I hope everyone will use this, bring it back to your treating healthcare team. It's very important information. Our next speaker is Denise Anderson. Denise is Senior Clinical Dietitian, Department of Clinical Nutrition, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Anderson is going to address nutritional and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Anderson.
Hi, and thank you, Carolyn, for asking me to do this again. I wanted to start out by saying that most treatments for head and neck cancer, have it be from surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, can affect your eating. These treatments will increase your need for nutrition and may require diet or texture modifications, and you may need nutrition support in the form of a feeding tube to meet your nutritional goals. Eating well during your treatment can lower your fatigue level by giving you the energy and keeping your strength up, as well as maintaining your weight. Patients that maintain their weight through treatment tend to tolerate treatments better and have a faster recovery from the side effects. To help you meet your nutritional goals, request from your doctor to see a dietitian. At that consult, they can provide you with your calorie needs, your protein needs, and your fluid needs. During this consult, the dietitian can also provide other information that can help you with eating and dealing with the side effects of the treatment. During treatment, weight loss is the most common side effect during your treatments. This is mainly related to a decrease in food intake due to increased difficulty in chewing, swallowing, and oral cavity pain. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays, breaks in treatment, and slow the healing process. The main nutritional goal during your treatment is to maintain your weight and preserve your lean muscle mass. This goal is also true for patients that are overweight. This goal can be achieved by meeting the calories and proteins and fluid needs that were provided by your dietitian. Remember that during cancer treatment, these needs may need to be increased, and the diet during the treatment tends to be high in calorie, high in protein due to the reduced size of your meals. So when looking at your diet, we need to kind of look at calories. Calories provide you the energy you need to maintain your weight and promote healing after treatment. Calories can come from carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. To help you meet your calorie needs, you may need to have small frequent meals and as many frequent meals as you need to reach your goal. Foods can also be fortified to add more calories to the small amount you may be eating during this time. Protein in your diet helps protect your lean muscle mass and aids in healing. The proteins that you eat, your body can use for energy and healing, sparing your lean muscle mass. This is best to include protein sources at each meal. Sources of protein include eggs, dried beans, dairy products, and meats. Protein supplements can also be purchased to help with protein intake. However, ask your medical team to review the product prior to use and to make sure that it is an appropriate supplement to use during your treatment. Both soy and whey protein supplements are okay to use. Adequate fluid intake will help keep you hydrated. Dehydration can make your side effects feel worse. It can increase nausea, dry mouth, thick saliva, fatigue, and make you feel tired and dizzy. Fluids are anything that's a liquid: water, juice, sports drinks, soups, milkshakes, smoothies, ice cream. If it melts to a liquid, you can count it as a fluid. While you're going through treatment, keeping a daily food record of your intake can be very helpful. It will make you aware of how often and how much you are eating. There are several calorie counters that you can use on the Internet. Also, reading food labels can be helpful. Food labels provide the calories and protein amounts in each food that you are eating. During treatment, diet modifications may be necessary due to difficulty swallowing and pain when eating. Patients may already be modifying their diets prior to treatments. An example of diet modification is that if you're eating a regular diet, this can change to a soft diet, then decrease to a chopped diet, decrease further to a pureed or blenderized diet, and then to a liquid diet. You may have to supplement your diet during these changes with smoothies and shakes, protein powders. There are also liquid supplements that are over the counter that you can use as well. So many different kinds are on the market, so it can get confusing. So check with your healthcare provider on what they recommend that you use for the supplements over the counter. Many recipes can also be located on the Internet for smoothies or milkshakes and pureed foods. Keywords to search for are things like liquid diet, dinner through a straw, blenderized or pureed diets. This can be helpful for looking for ways to prepare foods. Remember you can modify the recipe if you need to based on the side effects that you are having. If you continue to lose weight and not meet nutritional needs during treatment, a feeding tube may be necessary. Feeding tubes can be placed at any time during treatments. Patients who are underweight or have lost a large amount of weight prior to treatment may want to consider having a feeding tube placed prior to starting. For others, if you start having weight loss and you cannot control and continue to decrease your food intake, then consider placement of a feeding tube. Feeding tubes should not be considered long-term. The length of time you may have a feeding tube is different for everyone and depends on how nutritionally depleted you become. Feeding tubes can be used to help you achieve your nutritional goals and help you with healing after you have completed treatment. Once placed, the feeding tube can become your primary source of nutrition and hydration, however, not your only source. You can continue to eat by mouth even with a feeding tube, unless you have been told by your doctor not to. Continue to eat small amounts of pureed foods will help you preserve your swallow function, which can change and become weak, especially during radiation. Continuing to eat during your treatment will also help you in weaning off your feeding tube when ready. After cancer treatments, nutrition becomes important as well. You will want to continue to meet your nutritional needs to ensure adequate healing. If you had a feeding tube in place, you will need to work with your dietitian to help you decrease the use of your feeding tube and resume a normal diet. Long-term side effects that may affect your food intake after treatments is taste changes, no taste, and dry mouth. Continue to try different foods to help identify the foods that you may be able to taste. Taste may improve over time and with further healing. Remember that foods that you don't like prior to treatment you may like now, so try them. To help with dry mouth, you want to eat foods that are moist and avoid foods that have a lot of bread and breading. Using things like gravies and sauces can help with eating during this time. However, it's not very healthy over a long period of time. You may want to try to match flavors with, like, chicken broth when you're eating chicken or beef broth when you're eating beef. When starting to eat again, your diet may not be as varied as it was prior to treatment. Taking a daily multivitamin may help complete your diet. You only need a vitamin that meets 100% of your daily needs. Remember, the American diet is highly fortified, and you may be eating foods that already have added vitamins. As a final point, remember that your main goal is to maintain your weight and lean muscle mass. If you lost a lot of weight during the treatment and are still at your ideal body weight or above, you do not need to regain to your previous weight. Check with your healthcare team to determine if your weight is appropriate at this time. Remember, you can eat your way back into weight gain, but you cannot eat your way back into muscle gain. You have to rebuild your muscle. Your eating may never be the same as before, but as long as you get the foods in that you need and have a healthy diet, you'll be fine. Thanks again, Carolyn, for this opportunity. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, Denise. That was really wonderful, and just all the different recommendations for everybody to be able to take in adequate food and nutrition in different ways and creative ways. Thank you. And our next speaker is Caroline Edlin. Caroline is an oncology social worker. She's clinical coordinator of online services at Cancer Care. And Ms. Edlin is going to address with you the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Edlin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of the call today. So I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with oral, head, and neck cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with a diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to talk with other people impacted by oral, head, and neck cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and for your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help you. So please contact us at 1-800-813-4255 4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much, Caroline. That was really wonderful, and wonderful for people to know about all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Now, I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning this program, we recognize that you have many needs that go way beyond 1 hour program, and so I want to remind all of you to take advantage of all the services that Caroline has so eloquently described for you. I also want to comment that, indeed, in coping with oral and head and neck cancer, and in going through the various treatments and surgery, often people have a lot of worries and concerns, and I think it's a really, you have a whole healthcare team that Dr. Day and all the other speakers have really identified, and you actually saw most of that team today. Many of the different members of that team are on our call today. Please, if you have a question or concern or a worry, please know that you can talk to all those different people on your team, and you also can contact the staff at Cancer Care. Some of you may have questions that you didn't get to ask today that you might like to ask, or that you might think of something in the next week, or you may have a practical or a need for counseling, a practical need or a counseling need. Please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE. Again, we don't want any of you to think that you're alone in coping with oral and head and neck cancer. We want you to know that you're now part of this support area, community here at Cancer Care, and to please contact us. I want to thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.